Welcome to Art of the Christian Ninja, a podcast dedicated to helping you find the tools and inspiration you need to pursue a deeper, consistent, and more meaningful relationship with God. To learn more, visit the blog at artofthechristianninja.com. And now, here's your host, husband, father, pastor, author, and Christian ninja, Alan Deschanel.
A lot of illustrations that the Bible uses, that God uses to describe his people. Jesus was famous for stories, telling stories to explain things, likely because they lived in an agricultural culture. Jesus and Paul and the disciples used natural illustrations. In John 15, he says that we are the vine and he's the vine, we're the branches, and God's the gardener, who comes and prunes and strengthens the branches and then burns the fruitless ones. In the parable of the four soils, Jesus compared our hearts to hard soil or soft soil that is prepared or unprepared for the gospel that he's sprinkling his word on. In Matthew 13, the gospel and believers are likened to yeast inside of a batch of dough that's working itself invisibly through the dough, but having an effect that changes the composition of the whole loaf. In Matthew 5, his believers are called salt and light, forces of good, preservers of life, enhancers of flavor in the world, spreading the truth for all to see. Jesus called us a city on the hill, a net full of fish, a field of wheat mixed with weeds, a group of children, a flock of sheep, innocent doves, crafty serpents. When Paul is teaching how Christians can be very different but still work together in a church, he says that we are like parts of a body, the same body but different parts. Jesus is the head, we're all parts of the body. When we talk about new believers, he says that he likens them to babies who are drinking milk. When we're more mature and we're able to handle more difficult spiritual things, we're like adults chewing a tough piece of meat. When talking about spiritual war going on around us, then we're called soldiers, strapping on the armor of God and preparing for battle. When the church is praying or the church is singing, we're like priests who are burning incense with smoke that rises to the heavens. Each of these illustrations, and there are many, many more throughout Scripture, is meant to help us understand the many different sides of what it means to follow God and live in this world. I don't know if you've ever been asked what it's like to be a Christian. Less and less people ask. In fact, most of them just assume they know. But if you've ever been asked what it's like to be a Christian or what it's like to follow God, or if you've ever just started that conversation and you're trying to explain what it's like to be a Christian or follow God, it's not an easy thing to do. Well, you say, sometimes I feel like a baby who has no idea what's going on, but is just trusting my father to take care of me. Other times I feel like I'm a tool in the hand of a carpenter, being used to do amazing things that I could never do by myself. Other times I feel like I'm a piece of clay just kind of spinning in the hands of a potter, where he's gently but firmly molding me into something new, and I have very little to do with it. Other times, being a Christian feels like I'm a battle-hardened warrior, hurting and bleeding and covered in cuts and bruises, but standing once again to take on the enemy because I love my king and I love my kingdom. Sometimes being a Christian feels like you're part of a huge family of people that you love, but you've never even met. Well, at the same time, once God gets a hold of your heart, it's like the whole world gets flipped upside down on you, and now you live in a foreign land full of strange customs. All the things you understood before and made sense no longer make sense. And the waver between being tantalizing or disgusting or incomprehensible. Sometimes we're on the mountains shouting praise. Other times we're just resting by still waters. And then there are the times where we're walking through the valley of the shadow of death, just hoping our shepherd is taking us the right direction. It's a myriad of pictures. If you've been a Christian for any length of time, then I would imagine that you felt at least some of that. And you can appreciate why the Bible is so full of varied illustrations that describe a believer's experience, because it's not one thing. Open up with me to 1 Corinthians 3:1-9. While you do that, I just want to remind you that the box up here, so especially kind of kids who are coming to overtime, if you are going to come and you don't feel like you can ask a question because you're not, you know, you just don't want to raise your hand and whatever, write it down and just stick it in here and we'll cover it anyway. You don't have to raise your hand and try to form the question. You can just write it down and we'll do it that way. 1 Corinthians 3:1-9. We're going to read two more illustrations. We're only going to get through one today, but there's two more illustrations that Paul gives to explain how to live the Christian life. We'll start in verse 1 so we can get the context again. But I, brothers, could not address you as spiritual people, but as people of the flesh, as infants in Christ. I fed you with milk, not solid food, for you were still not ready for it. And even now you're not ready, for you are still of the flesh. For where there is, while there is jealousy and strife among you, are you not of the flesh and behaving only in a human way? For when one says, I follow Paul, and another, I follow Apollos, are you not being merely human? That's where we left off last week. Let's keep reading. What then is Apollos? What is Paul? Servants, through whom you believed as the Lord assigned to each. I planted, Apollos watered, but God gave the growth. So neither he who plants nor he who waters is anything, but only God who gives the growth. He who plants and he who waters are one. And each will receive his wages according to his labor, for we are God's fellow workers. You are God's field, God's building. All right, let's stop there. First, and as always, let's remember the context here. The Corinthian church has some maturity issues that they have got wrong with them. And God told Paul he needs to write a letter to them explaining some of these things to them. Paul had planted the church during his second missionary journey and had been their pastor for a year and a half, but had gone on to plant other churches. He wrote this letter from Ephesus during his third missionary journey, and after getting reports from a bunch of people that Corinth wasn't going that well, he decided he was going to write a letter. In fact, the whole letter is written as a response to the reports he was getting and an answer to questions from the delegation that had brought some issues to him. You can see that all the way through. Chapters 1 to 4 addresses it first, the most pressing problem, that being divisions which had cropped up in the church. See, in verse 11, you'll see it up here. It has been reported to me by Chloe's people that there is quarreling among you, my brothers. So that's what he covers first. Chloe comes running from Corinth to Ephesus, or she sends some people and says, you need to go tell Paul how crazy things are getting here in Corinth. He's got to know about this. So he spends four chapters addressing what Chloe's people has said. Paul addresses the problem. Chapter 5 starts with the next section, addressing the next report he's received. It says, it is actually reported that there is sexual immorality among you, and of a kind that is not tolerated even among pagans. And so Paul takes two chapters to deal with that report. Starting in chapter 7, we see all the now concernings, where Paul is addressing the questions of the delegation that came to him. It says, 7:1, now concerning the matters which you wrote, and then Paul talks to married people. 7:25, now concerning the betrothed, and he talks to unmarried people. 8:1, he says, now concerning food offered to idols. In 12, now concerning spiritual gifts. 16, now concerning the gifts for the saints. 16:12, now concerning our brother Apollos. He just keeps talking and answering questions. Paul's writing a letter to a group of Christians because he has concern for their spiritual health. He has condemnation for their reputation for sin. And then he gives counsel about how they can better their understanding of what they're supposed to be doing, change their behavior, and become more in line with what God wants them to do. And that ties all back into the illustration in chapter 3. To build the foundation for the rest of the letter and all the now concernings and all the reports he's going to address, Paul wants to make sure that they understand two extremely important things. Number one is that they need to understand the truth of the gospel, which they had forgotten. We've covered this over the last 19 weeks. He reminds them that in 1:30, wisdom is from God, righteousness, sanctification, and redemption is from God. It isn't found anywhere else except in Jesus Christ. I think we have that up here. No, not yet. Sorry. But that's in 130. He reminds them that all the human wisdom that they've been coming up with and all they've been listening to is actually foolishness, that they all they require to be right with God is done on through the crucifixion of Jesus. They don't need anything else. All the extra stuff they're coming up with isn't necessary. It's all folly. They don't need special knowledge. They don't need crazy experiences. They don't need demonstrations of power. They don't need to speak in tongues, whatever it is. They don't need it. Their salvation is by faith in Jesus Christ, period. In other words, God has done all the work. They don't need to do anymore. Which is why what Chloe's people says about what they're doing bugs him so much. The church wasn't full of the love of God, but instead was full of strife and jealousy and splitting into factions and putting their favorite preacher up as their de facto leader. A servant of God doesn't want any of that, especially one that's been preaching the gospel nonstop. It breaks his heart, it breaks God's heart to see Christian people divided because it's against the gospel. It goes against the very nature of the gospel. And then to hear that they're using your name as one of the leaders of the factions would be even more painful. A little sidebar here. I want to show you something. God hates it when people are divided. He literally hates it. There are things that God hates. We have some friends that they don't let their kids say the word hate because hate is a bad word. That's not true. Hate is not a bad word. Christians are supposed to hate things. God does hate things. We just have to make sure we hate the right things. So what does God hate? Here's some from Proverbs 6:16. He says this. There are six things that the Lord hates, seven that are an abomination to him. Haughty eyes, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans, feet that make haste to run to evil, a false witness who breathes out lies, and one who sows discord among brothers. Okay? He hates those things. So how do you think he feels about a church full of discord-ridden, strife-filled people who are abusing one another, literally starving some of them because they were too busy eating? He hated it. To watch them break into factions, and Paul hated it too. He didn't unsave them, but he hated their behavior. God really hates it when his people can't get along, and it is because it is then that they are most unlike him, when they most don't understand the gospel. Remember what Jesus said? Forgive as you've been forgiven. If you forgive, you will be forgiven. If you don't forgive, you won't be forgiven. Why? Because if you don't forgive, you don't understand forgiveness. You don't understand how much you've been forgiven. Therefore, when you're not forgiving, and when you're full of strife, and you're full of unrighteous anger, and you're jealous of other people, and you're coming down on them and dividing people, you are anti-gospel. You're being an anti-Christ. You're actually playing into the hands of the enemy. And so Paul, to remind them that dividing into factions based on their favorite preacher was sinful and ridiculous, he says this, "What then is Apollos? What is Paul? Servants. Servants through whom you believed, as the Lord assigned each. I planted, Apollos watered, but God gave the growth. So neither he who plants or waters is anything, but only God who gives the growth. We are God's fellow workers. You're God's field." So he points to all the humans that they're raising up, even the amazing ones like Paul and Apollos, and he says, listen, we are a tiny, minuscule, little, itty-bitty little part of accomplishing God's will for the world. What am I? What is Paul? What are any of us? A worker. We're just a worker. That's it. So Paul's first brief illustration is that the church is like a field, and Paul and Apollos are just field hands. God tells them where to go. God tells them gives them the tools they need to go dig. God gives them the seed they need to sow. God causes the rain to fall. God causes the sun to shine. God causes the seeds to grow. So it's ridiculous to elevate any preacher or teacher, no matter how gifted, to any kind of level, because their contribution to the church is so negligible compared to the work of God. Billy Graham, Charles Spurgeon, John Calvin, Martin Luther, Paul and Apollos were just farmhands. That's all they were. Each of these men were sinners who God chose for a time, not based on their ability, but despite their disabilities. More often than not, their great abilities actually became a problem for them. Billy Graham was born in the southern U.S., hardcore American. He was reluctant to even get saved, let alone become a preacher. It wasn't much for public speaking, and he often got confused between American culture and the gospel, but God called him anyway. Charles Spurgeon, British man, gifted speaker, but was more often than not in physical agony and was suffering with crippling depression. Sometimes he was literally unable to stand in the pulpit because of the weight on his heart and the weight in his body. He couldn't function. But God used him anyway. John Calvin was from France, and by all accounts I've read, was a super intellectual hermit who loved books way more than he loved people and was kind of a jerk. But he opened up his heart to God, and God used him anyway. More than once, people had to convince him, cajole him, even threaten him to put down his book and actually go obey God's call to preach. They had to threaten him. You know God's going to kill you if you don't do this? We all know it. The whole church knows it. You know it. Go obey. Martin Luther was a foul-mouthed, blue-collar, superstitious German with no understanding of the gospel, who only decided to become a monk because he was almost hit by lightning. Literally, that's his conversion story. I was walking down the road, and then I almost got hit by lightning. I freaked out, and I said, oh, fine, I won't be a lawyer. I'll be a monk. Just don't kill me. And then he went to become a monk. One day, God opened his eyes to see salvation through grace alone, by grace through faith. He was just reading the book of Romans. And though he struggled his whole life with a lot of personality weaknesses. You want some excellent insults to call your friends? Go read the works of Luther. There's some awesome insults in there. And he struggled with his whole life, but you know what? God used him anyway. The Apostle Paul was a Christian killer before he met Jesus. All these men, regardless of how different their contexts were, had two things in common. God had called them to work the fields, and they knew it was God who gave the growth. Paul is adamant. And if you read the biographies of all these great Christian men, so are they, that they are responsible for very little of the success of their ministries. In fact, it usually comes by total surprise. You read these biographies over and over and over, it's, I have no idea what we did. No clue. And that's why, you know, these church growth books make no sense, because you can't replicate what God is doing somewhere else in another context. It's about God blessing, period. Comes by total surprise. Often it comes despite their total failures. They mess everything up. They're in secret sin. They're not doing well with their families, and they don't understand what they're saying, and God's just sending people to get saved. And because of this, they know beyond a shadow of a doubt that whatever good they have done in their lives is solely because of the work of God. Sure, they sowed some seed. And yeah, they watered by teaching the scriptures. But at best, they are God's fellow workers. But it's God who did all the work, not them. And what's amazing is that God is still going to give them, it says, give them the wages according to their labor. That's amazing. Even though they had no power over the growth, even though they had no power over the maturity of the people or the harvest they were going to get. They didn't come up with the gospel. They didn't call themselves to ministry. Even though all of it was God, they're somehow still going to get wages for their labor. They still get to go to heaven. They still have the crown of life waiting for them. That's called grace, an amazing, abundant grace. Here's the thing. I'll talk to church folk for a bit. I've been around for a while. But listen to this. There's no magic formula you can cause to get someone saved. There's no magic formula that you can make someone grow in maturity. And there's no way you can grow a church. No magic formula. There's no magic words you can say to a non-Christian, or you can say to a backslidden child or spouse or friend or parent or anything that's going to make them want to put down their sin and turn to Jesus. You can't. I know this is a struggle for some people here. You have a friend, you have a family member, you have a workmate that you feel drawn to share your faith with. Or for that matter, they act like a Christian, but you know they're not. And you want to see them in the kingdom, and you want to see them forgiven, and you want to see them change, and you know they need God's grace, but they just won't receive it. And you blame yourself. And you think, if I just used the right words, if I had more answers, if I knew a little more about the Bible, if I had a better testimony, maybe if I would have shared it differently, maybe then they'd be saved by now. If I was part of a cooler church or acted a little different or knew more cool shows, then they'd listen to me because I'd be able to have better conversations with them. If I was more holy, less sinful, less tempted, if I just fasted more and prayed more and studied more, and then finally they'd turn their life over to Jesus. It's my fault. You think the reason they're not Christians is you, and that's not true. There's no magic words, there's no perfect system, there's no guarantee that you can do to change someone's heart. It's God who gives the growth, not you. In the same way, there's no magic formula, no perfect system, no mystical biblical secret to grow a church. Or a church ministry. It's not about how comfortable the chairs are, how great the music is, if your sound system rocks and your visuals are stimulating. A church with a gym or classrooms or a coffee shop or a bookstore may get some people through the door, but it will not guarantee that anyone becomes a follower of Jesus. It's a lot we could do at our church. There's no way to guarantee anyone will become a follower of Jesus. All the things we try at our church, from the welcome bags we're trying to make to the website, to the barbecues, to the coffee time, to overtime, to small groups, they're all fine. They're all fine. But they're not a guarantee that our church is going to grow or that the people within it are going to become mature believers. It's not. I can preach all day long. The deacons and trustees can build you the nicest building in the world. The coffee can be the tastiest ever. The band could win awards. And it won't mean anything unless God gives the growth. So how do we get growth? Personal, familiar, you know, children in our church. We ask God for growth because it only comes from Him. Ask any farmer how much power they have over their land. They can choose the best seed. They can't make it rain. They can buy fancy irrigation systems, but they can't make warm weather. They can build greenhouses and a water system and control the climate, but they can't make a bad seed grow a good plant. And even if they get everything right, seed, water, soil, temperature, sunlight, protection from bugs and blight, they still can't make the plant grow. they can create an environment where the conditions allow the plant to grow. God brings the growth. So, that being said, we are God's fellow workers. Just because God does the work of saving and growing people doesn't mean we are abdicated from our responsibilities to a worker. I get this question all the time. Every time I say I'm a Calvinist or that I'm Reformed, people say, well, if you believe that God does everything, why do you tell anybody about the gospel? Because God's going to do everything, isn't he? I'm not abdicated from my responsibility as a worker. Every single believer here today has been given the Great Commission to go and make disciples, to proclaim the gospel to the whole creation, to be God's witnesses to the end of the earth. We're all under that same commission. We're told to go. We have been told to scatter our seed far and wide. For some, that means that you tell people with your words because you're evangelists, like our little 9-year-old buddy there. He wants to tell people with words. He's going to open a book and show them and then tell them to read the word. And then he's going to say, you want to pray? And he's going to use his words. Some of you people are into that, using your words to tell people. For others, this means that you live such a life that others see it in you and want what you have. Open up to 1 Peter chapter 3. I want to show you something. I don't know if we have any feminists in the group, but this will be a trigger warning for you. We can explain it later. All right. 1 Peter 3, verses 1 to 2, says this. Likewise, wives, be subject to your own husbands, so that even if some do not obey the word, they may be won without a word. See that? By the conduct of their wives, when they see your respectful and pure conduct. Won without a word. Go make disciples, teach them. We all hear that. And the ones who are into talking go, yeah, I want to go share and I want to talk, I want to tell people. And we forget about the part of the Bible that says that you can win people without a word. Sometimes sowing our seed, being God's fellow worker, means talking. And you're disobedient if God says to open up your mouth and talk, and you don't. Sometimes it means influencing people by your conduct. Which means if you're talking, but your life isn't lining up with what you're saying, you're sinning. As a church, we got to get better at doing both of those. Not through fancy outreach programs. Not through rearranging the furniture. What we do as a church is personal evangelism, sharing our individual stories, and being careful with our conduct. That's what we do. That's how we're going to help our kids grow. That's how we're going to help our community grow. That's how we're going to serve and save and help God to save this community, is through our personal evangelism and being more careful with our conduct. God just doesn't call us to sow seeds, but also water them. In other words, after we've sown our seed through our talking or our conduct, we need to do all we can to create the environment or the conditions in which the plant will grow. What does that mean? That means that you are careful to make sure that you, your spouse, your children, people in your home have time to read the Bible and pray and serve with their gifting. If you're an employer, it means you allow your employees to have time to Sabbath. It means that you take care of people so they have the opportunity, the conditions, the environment to grow and serve. It means that you encourage the people around you, whether it be your spouse or your child or your parent or whatever it is, to connect with God in ways that they meet God best, not just the way that you meet God best. You should read this book. I liked it. You have to read it. It will change your life. The person says, I don't read books. I don't like books. I like audio stuff. I like sermons. I like listening. I like working with my hands. I like whatever it is. helping them meet God and connect with Him in ways that work for them. This means that you create a home environment. I'm talking to parents here and kids. I'm talking to you about your room here. I'm talking to you about what's on your computer here. Okay, this is changing your environment to make it a place that those who live there can grow in faith and love and obedience to God. That doesn't mean you hang cute posters on all the walls. That's not what I mean. I don't mean you have to say grace before meals and that's you're good and you're done. Posters on the walls are great, and saying grace before meals is a requirement. You should be doing that. But that every part of your home is turned over to God. Your TV, your internet, your movies, your games, your conversations, your daily schedule, your weekly calendar, it all goes to God, and because your environment, your conditions, you want everybody in this home to be able to be watered and grow. Why don't you turn with me one more place? Let's do Deuteronomy chapter 6, and we're going to go to verse 4. Jesus quotes this in the New Testament as the summary of the entire law and prophets. Okay, so this is like really important stuff. It says, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might." Right? Now watch. "And these words that I command you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children. You shall talk of them when you sit in your house and when you walk by the way and when you lie down and when you rise. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand. They shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall write them on your doorposts of your house and on your gates." So there's your case for posters if you want one. Every part of your life, the whole thing, rising up, lying down, wherever you go, is just saturated with God. You're constantly watering your plant. This means allowing your spiritual authorities to guide you. Now, kids, that means your parents. You allow them to guide you. Parents, that means you are good guides. If you're an adult, that means your church elders. You allow them to guide you. You allow them to, you come and talk to them. You submit to their authority as it reflects Scripture. When they set a boundary, you live within it. When they challenge you, you do your best to face it because they're trying to shape you into a believer. Let me conclude with this. We can't make anyone grow, but we can work as God's servants to spread seeds and then create conditions by which people can grow. God allows us to work with Him on that. So I want you to evaluate your heart. Are you fulfilling your mission that God has given you in your daily life to spread seeds, to water those around you? If not, ask forgiveness from God because He wants you to spread seeds, whether that's with words or without. Are you feeling unnecessary guilt because the person you are talking to isn't saved yet, and you feel like it's your fault? Let God be the one who gives the grace. Release that control. Accept that all you can do is love that person as much as God does, as best you can, and pray for them. And I want you to evaluate your homes. Kids, this means your rooms. Adults, this means your homes. Is it an environment that is building you up in faith, or is it a field full of landmines, spiritual landmines that are going to blow you and the people around you up? You know what these are, because when your kids come into the room, you hide them. These are things behind books and under your shelves and stuff. You don't want nobody to see. It's a spiritual landmine. You die tonight, people are going through that stuff. They'll find out who you are. They'll see your browser history. Kids, is there stuff on your walls that just remind you to be a consumer, to buy stuff? Do you get magazines in your house that just remind you that all the things you don't have and all the things you want and all the things you think you need to spend all your money all the time? Do you have a giant bowl of whatever it is simply because you want it there? Is your room an environment that will help you grow closer to God? Or do you lay landmines around your house that will spiritually blow someone up? Do you have hidden things you hope no one finds? Are your conversations godly? Sitting around the dinner table, are you building and watering the people around you? Or do they get to hear bitterness and gossip, complaints, whining? Do you have a high standard of godliness? Or for that matter, is your home a bastion of false religion? You got like a billion rules in your house that are absolutely unnecessary, that aren't biblical, and you're just cramming down the throat of anybody who walks in because you think that's how you're supposed to live? Do you embrace the joy of the Lord and all the freedoms God has given you? Or are you teaching people in your home to follow rules but not build a relationship with God? Scatter your seeds. Water your plants.
Thank you for listening to Art of the Christian Ninja with your host, Alan Deschanel. If you have any questions, you can contact Alan by clicking on the About Me button on his blog at artofthechristianninja.com. We hope you appreciate these podcasts, and if you do, please take the time to share them with your friends, rate them in iTunes, and like them on Facebook. And don't forget to check out the other podcast Alan does with his friends called Carnivore Theology, where they discuss contemporary issues with humor and biblical insight.